Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
Well, this is...
Here's John Williams.
A distressing one. Thank you for all of that, Kim. At least... You know, we've got way too much water today with all of the rain, the flash flooding. At least we don't have a giant iceberg ready to cleave off into the... Oh, wait. We've got that, too. A piece of ice the size of Delaware. So large, they say, in Antarctica. Is it now cracking away from that place?
So scary. And they said that they're going to have to change maps because of
that. That's the thing that scared me. We've got to redraw the maps. Because we don't have any sense of scale. I don't even know where Kentucky is.
Well, I live there, so I can tell you where Kentucky is.
But we digress. My point is that, you know, we don't really know. But when they say, well, it's the size of Delaware, that sounds really large. But when they say the maps will now look different as a result. Then you go, okay, now you've got my attention.
Right. Scary.
So we'll talk to an expert about that after 1:30. And then on the bright side after that, we expect to visit with one of the people that formed that human chain in Panama City. There was a riptide that was washing people out to sea. I don't know exactly how this happened. A child went out. Another child went out. The mother went out to save the children. The grandmother went out to save the daughter and the grandchildren. And as more people went out to rescue the people being swept out to sea, more people were in peril and themselves were about to drown. They were 100 yards out. Now, I don't know exactly what that means. Were they able to tread water and were slowly being carried out? Were they being whisked away? Evidently, they were stationary enough that the people on the beach noticed their peril. And they then, one by one, started to form a human chain from people standing in knee-deep water, linking their arms from the shore out to the sea, so that now some of them are in water over their heads. 15 feet deep is the water, but they're floating, treading, and holding onto this human chain so that they won't get pulled out to the tide. And enough people volunteered spontaneously to find these people and pull them in. Now, it would seem to me like the people being swept out to sea are a moving target. I don't know exactly how this all happened. But one of the women who was the instigator, hey, we've got to save them, is scheduled to join us before 3. She's a floating target, if you will, but we expect to visit with her before the show is over. Elif's been trading notes with her off the air. And another score that I'm interested in for us, and I think you'll find this just as uplifting, is the conversation we plan on having with Shante Lowe. She is the Olympic high jumper. We talked about her earlier this week. You may have heard our conversation or description of her story from Sunday's New York Times in a show earlier this week. The story is that she was in the 2008 Olympics, the 2004, I believe the 2000, and the 1996. My recollection is she's actually represented the United States in 4 Olympics, and she's never medaled. She's an amazing story because she grew up under such hard conditions, and yet she got herself to Georgia Tech, where she was a 4.0 GPA. This from a young woman who lived in a car, was in and out of shelters, sometimes with no shelter at all. Dad's in jail. He's a drug addict. Mom can't care for her. And yet she finds herself able to high jump. And she takes care of herself. She works for the New Yorker now. Oh, New York Life. Pardon me. The insurance company.
Yeah.
She's in the, HR department or an actuary or something?
She is in financial planning.
Financial planning. Can you imagine? So that's a great success story. That should be enough, right? And to be the U.S. national champion in track and field. I mean, think of all that she's accomplished. But it's bothered her all these years that she was never able to medal. That's why you go to the Olympics. She got a call last fall from friends saying congratulations, and she said, yeah, right. But they said no. The IOC has looked back at the blood tests of the people that finished ahead of you, and you've gone from 6th to 3rd. You're now... She found out in 2016, the 2008 U.S. Olympic bronze medal champion or bronze medalist in the high jump. And she did a little dance of joy right there in her kitchen. She's going to say hi to us and finish that story after 2:30. Now, before we do all of that, the top story of the day, the president says he doesn't watch much TV. We'll get to the Donald Trump Jr. TV episode in just a second. But I got to tell you, I had to laugh when the president tweeted today. And maybe to preface the tweet that made me chuckle and perhaps made you chuckle too. You need to remember that in the last 24 hours, the president has retweeted Fox and Friends three times, promoted his son's interview on TV, then watched his son's interview on TV, tweeted about that, and then tweeted this morning, the White House is functioning perfectly, focused on health care, tax cuts, and reform, and many other things. I have very little time for watching TV, the president tweeted, as if somebody had asked.
He uses what little time he has to watch his son.
I guess that's it. The only thing I watch is when my son is being grilled, air quotes, by Sean Hannity. Sean Hannity had him. All right, so you ready to play the sound, Olive? We'll start with Sean Hannity's pledge that this will be a thorough, questioning of the president's son.
We will ask him every single question I can think of on this topic.
Okay, and the topic is, of course, that the president's son and son-in-law and campaign chief took a meeting with a Russian that they did not know, but which may have led to information that would be damaging to the Clinton campaign from the Russians. Donald Trump Jr. said, if this is what you say it is, I love it. So Sean Hannity begins asking, what did you think when you got this famous email saying, hey, they may have the goods?
This email comes in. What are you thinking?
Someone has information on our opponent. You know, things are going a million miles an hour. You know what it's like to be on a campaign. We just won Indiana, but we're talking about a contested convention. Things are going a million miles an hour again. And, hey, wait a minute. I've heard about all these things, but maybe this is something. I should hear them out.
Okay. When you read the parts about the Russian government or Russia supporting your father, did that put off any sirens in your head?
Honestly, I don't know. I mean, I think this was, again, just basic information that was going to be possibly there. I didn't know these guys well enough to understand that if this talent manager from Miss Universe, you know, had this kind of thing. So I wanted to hear him out and play it out and see what happens. But, you know, people are trying to reach out to you all the time with this.
All right. So you spent a lot of time talking about it, and you actually said at one point that, hey, if it turns out to say what you say it is.
Of course.
What did you think it might be?
Listen, I'd been reading about scandals that people were probably underreporting for a long time. So maybe it was something that had to do with one of those things. I mean, this was her, perhaps, involvement with the Russian government. So, you know, again, I didn't know there was any credibility. I didn't know if there was anything behind it. I can't vouch for the information. You know, someone sent me an email. I can't help what someone sends me. You know, I read it. I responded accordingly. And if there was something interesting there, I think it's pretty common.
But you don't have to take the meeting, Donald Trump Jr. And so Sean Hannity says, you describe this person that you don't know, but has been sent to you by a talent manager from the Miss Universe pageant. And you're going to take this meeting. There are no red flags here?
This is pre-Russia fever. This is pre-Russia mania. You know, this is 13 months ago, before I think the rest of the world was talking about that, trying to build up this narrative about Russia. So I don't even think my sirens, you know, went up, or the antennas went up.
Did you know who you were meeting? Sean Hannity asks.
I didn't know who I was meeting beforehand, never heard of the person, never got the information until they were in the room.
I want to hope for Donald Trump Jr. and Jared Kushner's sake that they hadn't seen a picture. Oh, no, they saw a picture of the guy that set the meeting up. But that's beside the point. Have you been following Goldstone?
Yeah.
I have not seen a picture of that guy in a responsible suit yet. he is such a character. He looks like somebody that would be, I don't know, hanging out at a Hugh Hefner party from the 60s.
You know, there should be a party of those people, because it seems like every big scandal has a guy.
There's a guy.
Cato Kaelin.
This is that right? Guy. This is the guy that when they do the frontline piece and his picture rolls up, you're just going to slap your forehead.
G. Gordon Liddy would have been the one for Watergate. Kind of a little crazy out there.
Every one of these stories has a guy, and it's this Goldstone cat. But we digress. So they take this meeting with this Russian woman, this attorney who may have pulled a bait and switch on them. But there they are, stuck in this meeting. And she has since said on NBC that it was Trump Jr. himself who was pressing for information. So he's the one that was driving this query into the Russians and the Clintons, right? What about that?
So she is saying that she had no information to provide. Do you remember, but she's suggesting that you were pressing her a little bit for information?
I imagine I did. I mean, I was probably pressing because the pretext of the meeting was, hey, I have information about your opponent. It was this, you know, hey, some DNC donors may have done something in Russia and they didn't pay taxes. I was like, what does this have to do with?
So there they are sitting there kind of slack-jawed going, wait a minute. This isn't what we signed up for. We thought you were going to have goods on the Clintons and the Russians, and now you're talking about a law we never heard of and the retaliation by the U.S. government or the Russian government to freeze adoptions. So Trump says to him, or Hannity says to Trump Jr., did you think that a meeting like this might actually just be a bad idea? Did that occur to you?
Did you ever think maybe this might not be?
Listen, I think, like I said, in retrospect, I probably would have done things a little differently. Again, this is before the Russia mania. This is before they were building it up in the press. For me, this was opposition research. They had something, you know, maybe concrete evidence to all the stories I'd been hearing about, but they were probably underreported for, you know, years, not just during the campaign.
Sean Hannity asked him if there were any other email or notes. And, you know, he's not sworn. This isn't sworn testimony here. So whatever he is saying doesn't have to be the truth, right? But he does say this.
Did you hand over any and all documents?
Well, I will. I've said it publicly. I said it yesterday. I just want the truth to get out there. And that's part of why I released all the stuff today. I wanted to get it all out there. They're trying to drag out the story, in all fairness. Yeah. You know, they have it. They want to drip a little bit today, drip a little bit then. So I was like, here it is. I'm more than happy to be transparent about it, and I'm more than happy to cooperate with everyone.
So as far as you know, as far as this incident is concerned, this is all of it.
This is everything.
Okay. So now you know what that means. Somebody from Washington Post is right now looking for something.
I just have to say, you know, that it's just not true about the dripping this and dripping that. He was the one dripping. You know, he was the one with the statement on Saturday saying it was about adoption. And then he was with White House approval. Then he was the one Sunday giving a little bit more because the New York Times had more. Then he was the one Monday giving a little bit more because the New York Times had more. This idea of churning it as if, you know, he's being gone after. I keep joking about transparency, but it just bugs me.
Yeah, right.
Because it was not, it was the opposite of
transparency. Well, if you wanted to be transparent, you would have done it. And his idea, well, let's just get it all out there. Well, sure, you could have called the New York Times a long time ago and said, oh, by the way, I forgot.
Right. You're not transparent if you release something 5 minutes before a media outlet releases it.
Well, in fact, he didn't even tell his father. And for good reason, he said there was nothing there.
Do you tell your father anything about this?
No. It was such a nothing. There was nothing to tell.
To Sean Hannity and Fox News' credit, they played two montages of his critics. Here's a brief summary of that and Donald Trump Jr.'s response.
He was admitting that he had met with this Russian lawyer for the purpose of receiving information against Hillary Clinton. I thought, my God, this kid was dropped on his head as a child. Could he possibly be admitting this?
We're now stupid of Don Jr. I mean, I guess it runs in the family to go on Twitter when he is clearly in legal jeopardy.
This can't be dismissed as people out to get Donald J. Trump Jr. or fake news. This is evidence of willingness to commit collusion.
And we continue with Donald Trump Jr. What's your reaction to that?
Listen, I think politics is a dirty game. We've seen the sides that they take. We've seen the commentary they've had on my father. I think it's a little bit ridiculous and overplayed, and I think people are getting that. I think the media has really done themselves a disservice by picking sides so flagrantly.
What about anyone on your team? I guess you have a staff of people that work for you. Did anyone research the lawyer or anybody involved in this?
No. Well, again, we didn't know who it was before the meeting.
You didn't know who the woman was, right?
No, we didn't know who she was before the meeting. You know, apparently she's a prosecutor in Moscow who hasn't done that since 2002.
You know, in a way, and maybe this is their best defense, they were played. Even their advocates are saying that. Okay, it was a bait and switch by somebody they didn't know who may have misrepresented their intentions. So that's just a rookie mistake, and you can expect that from a team that is not yet even in the White House. This was in June of 2016. So, yeah, that's embarrassing, but that's all, says Donald Trump Jr. So then Sean Hannity has a hypothetical question for him. And I think this is maybe one of the more revelatory parts of the interview. That's next. Hold on one second. That's next here on GN. Okay, so we're wrapping up our just sort of bite-by-bite analysis. Maybe you didn't have time or the inclination to watch the whole Sean Hannity interview last night with Donald Trump Jr. We did. We're playing back some of the highlights for you. And some of you have a couple things you wanted to say. Tom, what was your thought on that so far? You're on WGN.
King John, man, I tell you, the most damning thing about that interview is the fact that Junior stated that he never shared any of that interview with his dad. The interview takes place on the 25th floor. His dad's office is supposedly on the 24th floor. I mean, if you believe that one, I got a bridge in Brooklyn for you. I mean, come on. I mean, you know, I think someone stated, I forget which senator stated it the best. Might have been Warner. The fact that you have a situation here that is beyond obstruction of justice. I mean, this is looking like the big T word. This is almost like Thomas Jefferson stating he never slept with a woman of color. I mean, that's incredible. Come on.
You know, the thing is, too, he would have told his dad. You know, what's also being lost in this is that this thing seems to be deflated because there was no actionable information. But what if there was? What if there was? Then they would have acted on it. Then they would have told their dad. Then they would have started colluding. They think it's not collusion just because there was nothing in the cookie jar. I think that's a weak defense.
Well, look at the former FBI director. You have a telling moment where the senator says to him, well, what if there's tapes? Well, what was the response? Oh, golly, wow, I hope there is. And what was the response on that email that Young Jr. stated? Oh, good, oh, good. I mean, I forget the exact word.
I love it. If he said, I love it.
I believe you're
misquoting them. That's fake news when you call in, Tom, and say, oh, golly, wow. Those were not the exact words they tweeted.
Can I echo something?
What's that?
So he said a couple of times, you know, well, this was before the whole Russia thing was crazy and it wasn't in everyone's front of mind. Well, I don't know if they colluded or not, but if they did, this is likely where it started. So, of course, there wasn't a Russia thing on the front burner. It started with that meeting.
Yeah.
There wouldn't have been something on the front burner.
Yeah, you should have called in on the Sean Hannity show. Tom, I'm going to take one more call. I really appreciate you listening.
All right, John. Take care, buddy.
Have a good day. Steve, you're on WGN. What did you want to say, Steve?
John, I just have a couple quick points, and I'll let you go. One is it this easy, really, to get meetings with quote-unquote billionaires? If so, I need to set up a couple meetings because there's a couple things I need in life who maybe these billionaires can help me. Secondly, you know, this broke on Saturday, I believe, or is about to break. And isn't it the same day that this 30-minute meeting with Putin turned into a 2 hours, 2.5 hours? Maybe there was some type of conversation as to, hey, this is coming out. Let's get our story straight as to what's going to come up so we know exactly how to proceed. I'm telling you, there's more to this. It's going to come out, and I can't wait for the chips to fall.
Steve, thanks for the call. It's 1:30. All right, let's do this.
I just need to say, though, the meeting was not on that day. The meeting with Putin was a few days before.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you, Tom. John Williams in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue, watching it rain and turn umbrellas inside out on the sidewalk outside our window. Sorry about that. So let's wrap up our sort of playback and analysis of Sean Hannity and Donald Trump Jr. from last night. Afterwards, we visit with a climate scientist. This will be in just a minute now, about that Antarctic ice shelf iceberg, which, by the way, is not by any stretch the largest ever. It's in the top 10, as you may know. But it's one of my favorites. They're describing it as twice the size of Luxembourg. That doesn't help me not knowing how big Luxembourg is.
I thought they said Delaware.
So then to dumb it down for America, they said, okay, the size of Delaware, but we don't know how big Delaware is.
I was going to say, no.
What they need to do is put it in terms of football stadiums. That's what we know. We know how big a football stadium is. If you said it's 1,000 soldiers field. Or soldier fields. Or soldiers fields. Anyway, if you said that, we'd have a clue.
Yeah, so we don't know football stadiums that well either.
Sean Hannity asked Donald Trump Jr. a question that Hannity described as a hypothetical.
If the meeting resulted in information that you felt in any way was illegal or compromising or collusion, to use the media's term,
I said it earlier, 100% I would bring it to the proper authorities. So there's nothing that I would do to ever endanger this country. I think the reason we fought so hard during this campaign, whether it was my father and the work that he put into it, whether it was the rest of our family and the efforts that we put into it, and you know those efforts well, it's because we'd do anything for this country. So we're never going to put that in jeopardy, ever.
Ever. So if that was hinky, if it was unethical, if it was illegal, if it was collusion, if you thought it was that, what would you have done? And he said, well, I wouldn't have done it. He said, I would have reported it to authorities.
So how could it have not been?
Because on its face, it appears to be that regardless of the outcome. See, they keep hanging it on, since nothing was there, we didn't do anything wrong. That's the thing that Sean Hannity, LF, the very first cut we played from Sean Hannity, at the beginning of his interview, this is the one that we didn't number, right? This is Sean Hannity's promise at the beginning of this interview.
We will ask him every single question I can think of on this topic.
Why didn't you think of that? Why didn't you say, yeah, but Don Jr., thank you for coming on. We're all on the same team here, but you've got to help me out. Don't you see that the outcome of the meeting is almost beside the point? Hannity didn't think of that question. He didn't think that that was something that needed to be pressed. Maybe it was an oversight. Okay, we'll keep posted. We'll keep you posted on how that story develops. I suspect his father will be tweeting about it again. A giant iceberg twice the size of Luxembourg, which is bigger than your nose, has broken off an ice shelf on the Antarctic Peninsula. I'm reading at MSN.com, and is now adrift in the Weddell Sea. You didn't know there was a Weddell Sea, did you? The Larsen Sea ice shelf is now 10% smaller as a result. It's one of the 10 largest icebergs ever recorded. Maybe that helps. But listen to this statistic in the story. There is enough ice in Antarctica that if it all melted or even just flowed into the ocean, sea levels would rise by 200 feet. But think about this. That ice mass was already sitting, floating in the ocean, or it was there. Now that it breaks off, it's still there, it's just in a different spot. One expert said this. While the birth of a huge iceberg might look dramatic, experts say it will not itself result in sea level rises. Quote, it's like your ice cube in your gin and tonic. It's already floating, and if it melts, it does not change the volume of water in the glass by very much at all. That's an observation that I tend to duplicate later this evening just to test the theory. We reached out to Yero Axford. She is an associate professor of Earth and Planetary Science at Northwestern University. First question, Yero, thanks for coming on with us. How are you today?
Hi, I'm well, thanks. So, thanks for your interest in Antarctica.
Well, my interest is more in gin and tonics. Do you drink gin and tonics?
Absolutely.
Excellent news. Okay, let's move on.
And the ice does float.
And let's move on to Antarctica then. Give me your sort of perspective on this. It's shocking. It's dramatic. I think the headlines are almost doing us a disservice because they're so upsetting. Talk a little bit about what a big deal this is or is not.
Well, so first of all, the question that a lot of people have is whether this particular event is caused by climate change or evidence of climate change.
Right.
And one thing we know is that we do expect that ice shelves that are subjected to enough warming will break up, retreat, collapse. And so when we see really unusual cracking, that can be consistent with warming. We think we saw that happen in 2002 when the Larsen B ice shelf, which is just north of Larsen C, the one we're talking about today, did collapse completely and very quickly, catastrophically. But whether this crack and this iceberg today in the Larsen Sea is a sign that this particular ice shelf is succumbing to climate change is really not known yet. And I think we'll see debate about that amongst glaciologists in the coming months.
Okay, but
ultimately,
finish your thought.
Ultimately, what might decide the debate about a link to climate change is whether we see going forward that this event is the beginning of more widespread changes in this ice shelf. Maybe over the next few years, we'll see this thing start to break up in a larger way and eventually collapse. Or maybe we'll see the ice sheet heal itself and learn that this may be part of a natural rhythm for this particular
shelf. So what happens to this mass of water, frozen, but this iceberg then cleaves off the shelf? Does it ultimately melt or does it stick around? What happens to that?
I think we expect to see it probably break up into smaller chunks as it melts and experiences different stresses from moving around in the ice in the ocean. And it'll melt, eventually just break up, melt away.
Well, will that cause a rise in sea levels? I mean, we're all describing this as this ginormous piece of ice. Will this have any effect on us in the United States or elsewhere?
A teeny bit, probably. But one thing that can help with understanding how various changes in ice that happen around the world affect sea level and might affect us is to recognize that there are really three different types of ice at the poles, including around Antarctica. One is sea ice, which is just a thin frozen skin on the ocean and just a few feet thick. It's a lot like what grows on Lake Michigan during a typical winter, maybe not our most recent winter, but a typical winter, we see a skin of ice on the lake. The ocean in cold parts of the world gets that as well. And that doesn't, it's melting when warm season comes along, doesn't contribute to sea level rise because that water was already part of the ocean before it froze. In contrast, we've got land ice, and most of the Antarctic ice sheet falls into that category. So on the continent of Antarctica, we've got a huge mass of ice that's, to wrap your mind around its size, think about Mexico and the U.S. smothered in ice that's 2 miles thick, and that gives you a sense for the size of the land ice in Antarctica.
Wow.
And that's the mass of ice that people are talking about when you hear the number 200 feet of global sea level rise. If all of that ice made its way into the world's oceans, it would raise sea level everywhere around the globe on the order of about 200 feet.
I've never but Antarctica is as big as Mexico and the United States combined?
It's huge.
Hold on a second. Steve, I don't know what your lead story is, but I think that that should be in consideration. I did not know that.
I've heard it's a very, very long and cold flight to get to research sites when you've got to cover a lot of that continent.
Yeah, right. You're just going over ice, 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 baby. Okay, stay right there. I want you to finish that thought in just a minute. It's 1:50. Yarrow Axford is a climate scientist, an earth and climate scientist, planetary scientist at Northwestern University. So I don't know if this is giving you pause and some comfort or if it's terrifying you. The more she talks, the better I feel about this. John Williams here. On a phone line is Yarrow Axford. She is an associate professor of Earth and Planetary Sciences at Northwestern University. We're talking about that giant Antarctic iceberg that has broken off from the Larsen C ice shelf, so as not to be confused with the Larsen B ice shelf. It's twice the size of Luxembourg. It's as big as Delaware. But if I have you correct, Yarrow, you say, but you know, don't be too alarmed by that. It's not going to significantly raise the level of water here. The real alarming thing for us to think about is what's happening to the land ice on Antarctica itself. Antarctica is a continent. Is that right, Yarrow?
Yes.
Okay. Just want to make sure I understand.
Antarctica is a continent. And we've talked briefly about sea ice, which is the frozen skin of the ocean. We've talked about land ice, which is a 2 mile thick blob of ice sitting on the continent. Yeah. And there's a third kind of ice, which is the one we're actually talking about today, ice shelves, which is what you get when that land ice spills over the edges of the continent into the sea. So when we're talking about ice shelves, we're talking about thick sheets of floating glacier ice that can be hundreds to thousands of feet
but
thick.
Doesn't the
chunk of that is what we lost today.
Isn't that the natural process of, I went to Alaska and they said, well, the ice is always pushing forward and cleaving off, and that's what happens with glaciers. Is this maybe like, will Antarctica make more? It's okay, it was a big piece, but this is just what happens there?
That absolutely could be the case. Yep, and I think we'll need to watch it going forward and see if that's what happens or if instead this loss of an iceberg is a precursor to something more like what we saw in 2002 when the Larsen B ice shelf collapsed completely. And the reason that we care whether that happens, well, one reason we care is because these ice shelves, when you remove them, it's a little bit like taking the cork out of a wine bottle and you free up the massive glacier that's feeding them to flow more freely and more quickly straight into the sea. And we saw that happen with Larsen B when that ice shelf went away. The glacier that had been feeding it started flowing faster into the sea, contributing to more rapid sea level rise.
Yeah, right.
And so that's the link potentially between ice shelves like Larsen C and sea level rise. If we lose the ice shelves, we create a more direct connection between the land ice and the ocean and allow land ice to flow more rapidly.
It's interesting to know. All right. I appreciate the wine cork analogy. That'd be two alcohol-related references during the course of this interview. Let's close with a discussion about gin. So what's your first choice? Do you go Beefeater, Bombay, Tanqueray? What's your choice?
Kind of a Bombay Sapphire kind
right,
of gal.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I got a bottle of that in the freezer. But I'll tell you what, the Beefeater is, for the price, I think almost every bit is good. You know what I'm saying?
It's all about the ice, really.
I think you found your perfect guest.
I'm a bit of a science dweeb, and yet here's a person who speaks knowledgeably and lovingly about my cocktail of choice. So, Yarrow, you and I have to visit again sometime. Thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Pleasure to talk with you.
Me and my Yarrow, as I like to call her. Steve's got the news. That's next here on WGN.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
All right, watch this.
Here's John Williams.
Here's just a little thing. This is just a little factoid that we were able to pull from our last interview.
Lord have mercy.
And I challenge you not to try and... Hi, I'm back. I challenge you not to share this with someone later. Today. It is that fantastic. So our climate scientist a moment ago reminded us that while this ice shelf sheet, this cleave, if you will, this iceberg that is cleaved off of or calved off of Antarctica, she says it's the size of, you know, Luxembourg times two or whatever. But that's not really what you think about when you think about the rising seas and the melting of Antarctica. You think about the land ice, the massive ice on Antarctica is as big as Mexico and the continental United States combined, 2 miles thick.
Wow.
Thank you, John. I can't wait to share that with my friends. That's amazing. Speaking of the oceans, so you may have seen this story, maybe you didn't. Panama City Beach in Florida, there's some folks out there swimming, everybody's having a great time over the weekend, and then they notice that there's a group of people that are struggling out in the water. The folks on the beach decided to form a human chain from the beach out to the water to rescue some folks from what was described in the news as a riptide from which these people could not escape. I think the reporting on this story has been really bad because they haven't described exactly what was happening to the folks out in the water or how the chain was able to reach them. But the woman who was on the beach and said, hey, wait a minute, we've got to do something, is a lady named Jessica Simmons. And producer Elif has found her, and she joins us now on WGN. Hi, Jessica. This is John. You're on WGN in Chicago. How are you?
Hey, John, I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Congratulations on behalf of everybody in this story and the world that needs good news once in a while. Thank you for what you did, Jessica.
And thank you. I do appreciate that. I don't see myself as a hero. A lot of people do.
That's the way the story's being told to me, and I buy it. All right. So, but can you just tell us your perspective? I mean, tell me how you came to this scene and what you saw.
Well, I was in the ocean as well, but I was on a sandbar. I was looking for sand dollars, and I kind of looked towards the shore to see if I could see my family out there, and they were all looking in one direction. The whole entire beach was looking in one direction.
Okay, pause right there. So you are out in the ocean, but there's a sandbar. So the water gets mm-hmm. deep, but then it gets shallow again, and there's a sandbar mm-hmm. out there. How deep is the water on that sandbar?
The sandbar was probably right to my knees.
Okay, so how far out to sea are you, though you're standing in water only up to your knees?
It was probably about 100 yards.
Wow, so that's interesting, isn't it? You can go 100 yards out, and then it gets shallow again where this sandbar is. Okay, keep going.
Yes. There's deep part that you have to get to the sandbar. So
right.
I swam back and I asked the people on the beach what was going on, because I automatically thought it was a shark or a dolphin. But as I stood up on the sandbar, I didn't see none of that. I didn't see the dolphins, and I didn't see a shark either. And I knew if I stayed on the sandbar, I would probably be eight.
Yeah, right.
I swam back to shore, and when I got there, that's when they let me know there was some people drowning. They couldn't get out of a riptide.
What do you mean? But this is where I get confused. It would seem to me like isn't a riptide a fast current of water going back out to sea?
Yes.
Okay, but
is.
if they were in that, then how are you all sitting there watching him? It would seem to me like they'd be gone by now. What were they doing?
What happened was that we have a pier here in Bay County that is about 1,500 feet long. They were all the way out there. They had struggled and fought all the way to almost where we could see them, because 1,500 feet out there, they just look like a little speck. And we were able to, they have been struggling to get to us. And when we could finally hear them, that's when people started looking on the beach, because they were screaming at people to help them.
And these people, though, that were 1,000, 1,500 feet out, were they able to stand as well like you? Was it relatively shallow water?
No, when they were 1,500 feet out, we couldn't hear them, and it just looked like little specks. They were so exhausted from swimming up to us. When we could finally hear them, they were at least about 300 yards from us.
Okay.
We could hear them from there.
So they're sort of swimming back against this current, but they're struggling and they're yelling for help.
Yes, exactly. And only two of them have floats out of the nine. So you can only imagine how exhausted the ones were that did not have a float.
And my understanding is that's a family of people, and that one had gone out after the other to try and rescue each, huh?
Yes. And then two other families. There was a girl named Tabitha. She is she was by herself, and then there was a couple, an Asian couple. They somehow all got sucked into the same riptide. So there was a family of six, one girl, and then a couple. That made a total of nine people that was out there.
So you're watching this now from the shore, and you're watching this group of people struggle to get back in, but also fighting the current that's pulling them out. So it sounds like they're maybe in a neutral position. They're not gaining any ground, but you can at least see them there. Okay, so now what happens?
Well, like you said, they wasn't gaining any ground. They were fighting and fighting, and they were yelling at us to throw them a rope. They were upset because the police had showed up, and the police couldn't do nothing either because of the current being so strong. They were waiting on a boat, but it never showed up until the very end, when we had already gotten everybody out.
Well, where's the lifeguards? And don't they have paddle boards or surfboards or something?
Yes. Now, the lifeguards get off at 5 o'clock every single day. No matter what, they get off at 5 o'clock. So it's swim at your own risk after that time. And it was about 6:30. Paddle boards, they didn't have paddle boards or anything like that, but there was a guy out there that had a surfboard, and he was surfing the waves, because the waves were about 3 to 4 foot tall. So he was out there swimming and surfing it, and at first I got a little angry, because I was like, this man has a surfboard and he's not helping these people.
Dude, stop surfing let's go.
But as I swam out there, I realized he was part of the riptide. He was also out there and got stuck in it when he was surfing, and he had the Asian couple on top of his surfboard.
Okay, so now you're watching this from the shore. So now, and everybody, the cops are there. Nobody has a plan, and we're waiting for a boat that doesn't show up. So then what happens?
Yes. So we have, my husband comes over, because we had my whole family there at the beach. So my husband walks up, and there's some guys that are talking among themselves, trying they can do, and you can hear over in the distance them yelling at us, throw a rope, throw a train, throw a rope, do something, we're drowning. So my husband says, we got to do something, we got to get out here, and he's talking to the beach, everybody out there, they're all looking, and he's yelling, he's like, we got to get something done, we got to do something. Well, that's when my husband, there was three other guys. I don't know any of their names. They were all strangers. Three other guys and two women. One of them was a nurse, but none of them could swim. The guys couldn't swim and the women couldn't swim. And so they said, let's form a human chain. We can't throw a rope out there, but we can make one. So that's where the whole idea of going arm to arm, wrist to wrist, all with each other to make a human chain, because we knew we could support on each other to bring us back in. And that was remarkable in itself to see that many people, 70-something people that don't know each other, support and depend on each other to get each other in.
You say we knew that we would be able to get back in, but the riptide being what it is, I think that was a risk on everybody's part. For all you right. know, the chain breaks, and now a whole bunch of you are out there.
Well, we never got out far enough where we could not have our feet. If you can plant your feet, you can move. You can get through a riptide.
You say that, but wait a minute. I've been in a riptide before, too. You know, you're being modest here. I've been in a riptide before where I was able to tread water and touch, and that was terrifying. And it can, you know, it can carry you. You cannot anticipate what's going to happen, but fair enough. So the chain's going out. Now, are you on the end of this human chain as people are volunteering and extending out to the water?
No, I was the actual person who went out there and got them close enough to the human chain, because by the time it grew up to 70 people, there was still a 15 to 20 foot difference between them two. And they wasn't making no time, and they wasn't getting anywhere. They were staying stabled. And so I swam out there. I took the boogie board to the mother, and I got the mother and the child out first. Them to the human chain.
Okay, stop right there. So, Jessica, you're saying that the chain goes out, but it's still 20 feet or so from these people.
Yes.
And the water's swishing through. And so but then you are out there and you go out, get them, and then bring them back to the human chain. Is that it?
Yes, because they, at the very end of the human chain, we had guys that were 6 foot something. Their heads were the only thing sticking out of the water. They had arms out trying to reach for them, but it was just too far, and we couldn't get any more people out in front because it would be over their heads and that, you know, they can't touch. We wanted to make sure everybody could have their feet dug into the ground so that when they were able to get the people, they could start pushing them back towards shore.
You know, we have a riptide problem in Lake Michigan, particularly on the Indiana and Michigan side. I don't know if it's so much on the Illinois side, but it's the way the lake was built and, you know, it's formed and the tide and all that. But it's just terrifying. So there you guys are. You're reaching out and you're now going back and forth on the boogie board and grabbing these people and putting them back on the chain. And then do they just pass them down like a bucket brigade, one person to the next?
Yes. So they end up being pushed, like the guys that were all on boogie boards when I was pushing them, and then they'd give me the boogie board back, and I'd go out for the next person. And then we got a group of three of them on a surfboard, and I was me and another guy got behind the surfboard, and we were pushing the surfboard towards the chain, and they were able to grab the surfboard and take the string of the surfboard and the string of the boogie board and pass it along to the next person until they were able to touch. And then we had a group of people that would go out in the water, grab them, and bring them back in that was not part of the human chain. They were just there to get them when they could touch.
You know, and the video that I saw, it was just very brief, and it wasn't that descriptive of what you've been telling us, and I so appreciate that. But you see, you know, tall people, short people, people who don't look real physically fit, and yet they're volunteering. Old, you know, black, white. I mean, it was just so not. I don't mean to overstate this point, but it was sure nice to see people all come together from different stations in life to help somebody out.
Right, exactly. That was probably the most remarkable thing about the entire process was that. These are people who dropped everything from their, because it was a beautiful day and everybody had their families there. And instead of being on their cell phones and being on their and taking pictures of what was going on, everybody dropped that and went out and helped. That's why there's not so many pictures.
You're right.
That's why there's
not
any video.
Yeah.
It's because nobody was on it. They weren't standing around. They were actually helping. And that was a remarkable thing to see.
Jessica Simmons was on a phone line, and I need to let you go, Jessica. And by let you go, I mean not set you adrift. Have you been, you've been hearing from people all around the country, have you?
Yes. I spoke to people in Brazil and Italy and London. I actually got to find out who the family was. I got to meet them for the first time yesterday. The family that we saved. I didn't know their names. I've never met them in my life. And I actually got to meet them and tell, and you know, they got to tell me thank you and all that. We're still looking for all those people out there that helped that day, though. We only know a few.
Oh yeah,
but there were 70 of them. And
that would
they
be a great
heroes.
That would be a great People magazine story where they put everybody back on the beach. You know, and just like a group photo and tell the story, you know, what will happen too is that 900 people will show up going, yeah, I was there. I was the one that saved them. But it's a wonderful story. Thank you again for doing it. And thank you for sharing your time with us. I know you've been obviously very busy, but we sure appreciate you telling us the story here.
Oh, thank you very, very much. I'm glad to be on your show.
If you're ever in Chicago, come visit our studio and we'll go to the, and I'd like you to come to the beach with me because I do swim in the lake here, okay?
Oh, okay, great. I've never been there, but I will definitely take advantage of that.
Thanks, Jessica.
You too. Bye-bye.
Simmons, part of the human love chain. It's 224. WGN. The other day we were talking about that Shantae Lowe, who in 2010 in Des Moines, Iowa, set the U.S. women's national high jump record. This woman, measure this on the wall with your kids and marvel at the ability of human beings, jumped 6 feet, 8 3/4 inches. She jumped 6 feet, 8 3/4 inches into the air all by herself. No trampoline, nothing. Landed and set the record. She never medaled in the Olympic Games, but came close. And then the story is told in the New York Times on Sunday, not only about all of the sort of travail she had as a child and as a young woman, but the fact then that she did medal in the Games. And when we told that story, you guys said, well, shoot, get her on the radio. And so Elif did. Shantae Lowe, this is John Williams. You're on WGN Radio in Chicago. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, John.
As a track athlete, I can relate to the thrill you must have experienced being able to jump that high.
It felt like I was flying. I have to admit, it was like a childhood dream come true as an adult.
You mean when you jumped 6 feet eight and set the record, or when you found out that, in fact, you were the bronze medalist?
I would say a little bit of both.
So just let's start with the first thing, and that is you were in the 2008 Games. How did you do, and how did you end up medaling years later? It was told in the story, but for those who didn't hear it, just talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, in 2008, I was finishing up my senior year in college. My husband and I had just had our first daughter in 2007, so we had, you know, a nursing one-year-old. So, it was a lot of work to even get to that Olympic Games. And I went to the competition. I did the very best that I could do. I felt like I left everything that I possibly had out there on the track, and I fell short. I ended up getting sixth place.
Where was that? What country was hosting?
This was in Beijing. It was an amazing event.
Yeah.
I marveled at the hospitality of the country and then even the ability to even pull off such an amazing Olympic Games. But, you know, I went home kind of feeling like a failure because I didn't medal. If you watch the Olympics, they only care about who got gold, silver, or bronze. So, you know, even though I jumped the best I had that year, it wasn't good enough.
2008. So that's 2008. So you come home, and then what happens?
So I come home. Do you want me to fast forward to 2016 when I get the news?
Well, yes, I do. But, I mean, then did you compete in 2012 also?
I did. I also competed in 2012. In between 2008 and 2012, there was a lot of financial benefits that come with getting a medal. Because I didn't get a medal, I didn't get those benefits. And my husband and I ended up going through foreclosure. So, we lost our home. We went through we experienced what a lot of Americans were experiencing through the recession and
the housing collapse.
Hard time with the economy. Absolutely. So we didn't have, and it was hard to get a job. So even though I graduated from one of the, great universities of our country, I was not able to obtain a job.
Georgia Tech,
and
right?
So, Yep, I graduated from Georgia Tech.
with the New York Times reminded us a 4.0 GPA.
Yeah, they made it sound a little better than it was. It was that I got a 4.0 my senior year.
Oh,
so, really
okay.
A lot of hard
okay,
work.
Fine. you skater. So there you are, an Olympic athlete, evidently a delightful person and very bright, and yet you are struggling financially. That sounds like forever ago, but it wasn't that long ago. That was a lot of realities in 2008. 2012, you're in the Games. 2016, you represented the United States in the Olympics, too. Is that right?
Absolutely. So 2012, I had another one-year-old, so it was our second child, another nursing one-year-old for that Games. I placed, I think, sixth or seventh again. I think once I didn't get on the medal, I think it was seventh. And then in 2016, this was my best shot. This time I didn't have a nursing one-year-old, maybe a two-year-old
yeah,
instead. And then I ended up placing fourth, and it was kind of like one of those surreal moments. I was the last jumper in the competition, and if I cleared it, I would have gotten gold. But if I didn't clear it, I get nothing, and I ended up just scraping it off at the very end.
So later in that year, 2016, you start to get text messages, Facebook posts, phone calls from friends saying congratulations.
Yeah, so, you know, I finally got over the heartache of not getting a medal. It was hard for me, but I was spending some time by myself cleaning up the house. And, you know, I don't know where the kids were. My husband was taking a certification exam because we're like, once again, okay, we have to, you know, start going out into the job market again. And I started getting messages from other Olympians. Congratulations, congratulations. I'm like, what are you guys talking about? I failed. Why are you saying congratulations? And you're like 2 months too late. And so I see congratulations, bronze medalist. And so once I see that, I click on the link that one of my fellow Olympians had sent to me. And it was the gold medalist from Beijing who actually let me know that there were doping violations from the 2008 Olympic Games. There were a total of three in my event that would place me for the bronze place medal.
So 8 years later, they sample that blood. I mean, I guess the testing technology advances and they hold these samples and they tell these people, guess what? Bronze medalist and fourth place and fifth place, you were all cheaters. Sixth place is the legitimate third place, and that's how you get a bronze.
Yes. And, you know, at first I thought it was kind of crazy when they would keep samples for so long. They let you know when you're doing doping drug testing that they will keep your samples and you have to sign and consent to it. And I am so grateful that there was, in a sense, this like insurance policy saving me that was letting me know that they do in fact save these samples and they allow the technology to catch up to the methods of cheating.
So does it feel like a moment lost or a moment gained for you?
Oh, it's both. You know, it rewrites my story. And my story was that I was, you know, I went to the Olympics four times and I wasn't able to come home with anything. And now instead of being a four-time Olympian, I'm a four-time Olympian, the American record holder, and now I'm an Olympic bronze medalist. So it completely rewrote my story.
Do you want to have your own little ceremony, your husband and the kids? Does Georgia Tech or the U.S. Olympic Committee have – I want you to be able to stand on a thing and watch the flag.
Yes, I definitely want to do that. There's been news outlets that have reached out to me and asked me if they could be the ones to do my ceremony. The blessing about it is, you know, now my husband and I, we have our three kids here. At the time, we only had one child, so now we have three. I would love for them to, like, hand the medal down the line to each other and for the oldest child, the one that was there for 2008, to place it around my neck. That would just be the best moment ever for me. That would be one reason why it would be worth it to have to wait this long.
That'd be even better.
Exactly.
Or maybe not. That's presumptuous of me to say because I I really feel like you were cheated and denied a moment. But that's, I think, making lemonade, that's for sure. Do they have to acquire the actual physical medal from the fraudulent bronze medalist?
Yes, they do. My understanding is that they attempt to acquire it for a certain period of time. As you would imagine, a lot of these athletes, they remain that they are innocent. They say that they're innocent, and they say that they don't want to admit guilt, and they feel like turning over that medal is admitting guilt. And so it's going to be a fight. If it becomes too difficult for them to acquire that medal, then they will make me a new one, which I would honestly prefer to have a new one.
Are you mad at them or this?
I want to be mad, maybe, but at the same time, I have to imagine, like, I can't even imagine what type of pressure it would take to cheat, because cheating was never an option for me. The only time I do get upset is, you know, like 2 days ago, I was woken up at 6 o'clock in the morning. Drug testers come to my house. You know, I'm still in my pajamas. My kids are asleep, and I'm having to do drug testing, you know, this early in the morning. And to believe that everyone's not being held to the same standards, it upsets me.
For what purpose was that test?
They just do random drug testing. So here in America, we have drug tests randomly. They could be as much as 3 or 4 times in 1 week.
But for what event? Wouldn't that testing be relevant to a particular event or meet? Or say you flunked that test, then what would the consequences be?
Oh, I'd be banned just like anybody else. So we don't only do drug testing at meets. We actually do them at home throughout the entire year. So every 3 months, we're responsible for telling them where we will be every hour of the day for 3 months. And if we change that plan, we have to send them a notification, because if they come to test us during that time, we'll have what's called a missed test. And if you get 3 missed tests in a year-long period, you get suspended.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, and, you know, I'm out of time here, but we were also touched by your story. If, say, you were not the bronze medalist, I hope you also have a sense of how inspiring your story is, given how difficult your childhood was, that you've been able to achieve the things you have is in itself a great victory. I'm sure you must know that.
I do. I finally got to the point, and that's where I found my solace. I finally got to the point where I feel like, yes, my story is a success, whether or not I received that medal. And I think that there's a lot of things that I've been able to do in my life, and I feel like I have a story that I could share with other people and show them how to overcome difficult situations and let them know that they do not have to be a statistic. There are opportunities available to you, and sometimes you have to dig deep within and know what you have and what you're made of and how to define your own success. So, you know, it's my goal to go out now and help, you know, individuals, families, and businesses understand that, motivate their, you know, motivate themselves, motivate their employees, motivate their students. That's my job now, and I take it very seriously.
Are your mom and dad still alive, and what do they say about all of this?
My mom is still alive. My dad is alive. I don't really have too much contact with him, but my mother says she's very proud of me. She's doing a great job now. She's, you know, she's fighting the demons of her past, and she's had a complete turnaround. So her life, she said that my life has been inspirational to her, and that I have caused her to want to do better in her life, and she's really inspired to be there for her grandchildren. So she's, you know, she's come full circle, and now I have that relationship with her that I wasn't able to necessarily have earlier in my life. So it's been a blessing for me.
If you ever find yourself moping around going, well, this is hard, I can't do it, my life's not fair, read the Shantae Lowe story, the conditions of her childhood and the success she has enjoyed since, and you will find inspiration. What a pleasure to visit with you. You work for a New York Life, the insurance company now?
I do. I help families now, so it's my sole purpose to help families prepare for the future.
Thanks, Shantae. Congratulations. I can't wait to see the video of your children handing you your Olympic bronze.
Thank you, and I look forward to hopefully talking to you again in the future.
You know, if you ever want to talk track and field, I jumped 20 feet, 1/2 inch for Manuka High School back in the 1970s.
That is nice. Maybe one day we could do a friendly competition.
Please.
20 feet. Just tell my friend Steve Bertrand that a 20-foot-long jump is pretty impressive.
It is very impressive. Yes, it is.
How far can you long jump? 100. How far can you long jump?
It's been a while. Yeah. It's been a while. I don't know what it is. It's 690 in meters, so I'm not exactly what that translates to.
Yeah. 690 in meters.
It's a little short of 20 feet, John. I think it's
6'8". Measure 6'8" on a wall and then go, she just ran up and jumped over that. Shantae, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
my favorite track athlete. Kevin was listening to our conversation with Shante in the sports department, and I challenged her to a friendly long jump competition, as that was one of my events.
I like it. Maybe out in Pioneer Court, right along Michigan Avenue.
So she said, well, I don't know how long I've long jumped. She said, you said you went 20 feet. Because you know those high jumpers, they can't long jump. They jump high. She said, but my record is 6.9 meters, and she didn't know what that was. The ever-helpful Elif said, well, I'll look that up. It's 22 feet 7.
And you did 20 feet?
Yeah.
That's still pretty impressive.
That's impressive, but she's got me beat by 2.5 feet.
She's an Olympian, though. I'm more impressed by you, John, to be honest. What a story that was, though.
Isn't she a marvel? Wild. Yeah. And really, I mean, I didn't want to dwell on it, but and I don't know if she wants to dwell on it, but this is a young woman who, when she's setting records in high school and track and field, is sleeping in a car, sometimes sleeping with no shelter at all. Her dad is in jail. Her mom isn't able to tend to her. She's being farmed off to different family members. And she says, well, I'm just going to go ahead and do it. And then, you know, gets herself a scholarship and then gets a 4.0 GPA or senior year in college. That's, you know, that's the kind of story that you go, yeah, I guess I don't have it so bad. Right. But I did jump 20 feet, and it may actually be 2.5 inches. I don't remember if it was 20 feet half or 20 feet 2.5.
Maybe those blood samples from when you were in high school in the 70s will emerge, and you'll somehow, I don't know, maybe finish in the top three in your conference or JV or maybe something. John, I'm not sure where you were competing exactly.
If they do the latent drug testing, they would find trace amounts of Pabst and Old Style in my blood test. Rokan, Anna DeVlantis, and company.
Hi, John.
In the studios.
All here and accounted for.
Right, yes. I'm going to get you He's already started. I'm going to get you back on track. I'm going to get you closer to starting your show on time.
Okay.
Right now, Ro.
Okay. Thank you very much, John.
So you're on your own.
I appreciate it.
No longer going to aid and abet your demons that haunt you during the next 4 hours.
I don't have demons. By the way, we're going to have... yesterday we did American Idol traffic, traffic.
I thought it was
traffic
a hit.
Idol. Today it's going to be Traffic the Voice.
Oh, God. Singing traffic?
We have a number of different people doing traffic. None of the different characters on this show will be doing traffic. Ted Cruz traffic, Johnny Depp traffic.
Oh, great.
At all.
I thought Kevin did a really good job yesterday, just because for the little, what was the little...
big deal, John. Thanks. Appreciate it.
You know, no big deal.
Started begging for a little compliment.
Doing traffic.
There, so
I love that.
Worked out.
Yeah.
But who actually won?